Yeah, as Joshua mentioned, I am going to be talking about my story and my mental health journey and how it pertains to recovery. I have some notes. I'm going to try to not just read them at you. And I'm going to time myself so that I don't get, down some rabbit hole somewhere. So I did turn off video. Yes. I think if you remove the spotlight, then that'll probably take care of it. Good. Cool. Okay. So, just kind of to get started as background, my childhood was probably pretty relatable to a lot of you, I'm sure. My mom is an alcoholic. She's very narcissistic, and extremely codependent. My dad is a workaholic. He's also very codependent. He has a lot of rage issues, has a really bad temper. And I have one brother who's 3 years older than I am. My parents are still married. They have been for nearly 40 years, maybe actually even 40 years this year. I'm not really sure, but way too long. They never set an example of what a healthy relationship looked like for me ever. I just watched dysfunction my whole childhood, and that's what I learned to do. And so as I grew up, I emulated that in all of my own relationships for quite a while. When I was young, my dad was very emotionally abusive. Occasionally, he would also get physically abusive with my brother a lot more than anybody else. My mom was emotionally abusive. She was extremely codependent, as I mentioned before. She was very much reliant on my brother and me for her emotional well-being. For as long as I can remember, I knew I had this innate just knowledge that she needed me to be her emotional support person, right? Like that was my purpose in her life was I had this little girl and she's gonna fix me. There was a lot of emotional incest that took place as far as, she was leaning on me as she would or as she should have been leaning on my dad, her partner, as well as, she would share a lot of intimate details about their relationship and their physical relationship that I had no business knowing as a child, but certainly not as her child. Growing up, we moved around a lot. I've moved 21 times in my life. We were following my dad's job most of the time, and it was always to get more money. When I was growing up, I always had this just knowledge that money was the most important thing to him, and it was more important than any of us. It was more important than anyone else. Money was the thing, and so we always did anything that we had to make my dad more money. Because of that, we ended up living in very rural Oklahoma for a number of years. Population was about 800. The next closest town was about 30 miles away. And the population of that was only about 45,000. So it was still pretty rural. But that was, the big city. While we lived in Oklahoma, I was homeschooled, if you can call it that. My mom would drink, starting at 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon and just be done by 8 or 9. And she would sleep until about noon. And then in between there, from about noon till maybe 2 or 3, she would teach us things, but it mostly consisted of watching like History Channel documentaries or, so we watched the presidential debates at one point and things like that, things that were vaguely educational. But I had textbooks. And so I would work through the textbooks on my own. And I taught myself, several grades worth of math that way and things like that. While we lived there, I was completely isolated from everyone except my family. I am not being hyperbolic when I say that I had literally zero friends. I had no one for many years, because I was the awkward homeschooled kid, right, in a tiny town in Oklahoma. And if you weren't one of them, then you had no one. I did have one connection, my cousin Lindsay, who lived 90 miles away in Oklahoma City. But it was long distance to call her for whatever reason, even though we lived in the same state. So we didn't get to talk too much on the phone. She used to come spend summers with us, and we would have that time, which was really nice. But we wrote letters to each other constantly, and we were obsessed with the Lord of the Rings books and movies. And so when we wanted to share something secret with each other, we would write it in like elven runes and decode it on the other side. But otherwise, besides Lindsay, I was stuck at home with my family. My alcoholic mom, my dad was very absent all the time. When he wasn't working, he was, doing his hobbies, running or whatever. And then my brother, who really wanted nothing to do with his super nerdy little sister. So I felt really, really alone. I was literally and figuratively isolated. And I remember when I was young, I would lie awake at night, and I would imagine if I were at an orphanage and there were these prospective parents coming in to see the children and choose who they wanted to take home. How could I be what they would want? What would I need to do? Who would I need to be somebody that someone would choose? And that's what I would think about. And I wished that I could be that. When I did leave the house, I was bullied a lot. The kids did not like me, and so they let me know. But I did used to spend like all day every day at the pool during the summer. That was like my place. I would go swim all day long by myself, but that was fun. The rest of the time, I was grateful enough I had a computer in my room. So I'd spend my time on my computer, and so I learned how to code, and I played around with paint all the time, and I did all these fun things. I did try to go to church. My parents took us to church most Sundays, but I had a really hard time reconciling what I heard at church and the messages that were being given versus how people were living and how they were behaving and the way that they were treating people in their lives. And it really did not sit well with me. I tried to, well, I did actually go through confirmation class. I didn't do it for the spiritual aspect. I did it because there were peers in there. There were kids. I wanted to talk to them. I wanted to hang out with them. I wanted to make friends, and I was bullied there too, pretty badly. And actually, at the actual confirmation in front of the whole congregation, my brother had done it too, and there were, six or seven of us kids standing up in the front, and I was so nervous, and I had had so much stress and anxiety about all of it, and I ended up passing out in front of everyone, and my brother caught me, thankfully. He actually still has a scar on the back of his hand from where my head would have been. But anyway, that's why I have a timer, so I like to put on these little. But when I was about 11, my parents decided that they were going to get a divorce, which, spoiler, didn't happen, but they were. And that's when I learned that my mom was an alcoholic. I had no concept of this before that moment when my dad was standing in the doorway with a suitcase about to walk out and leave. And I asked him why. And he said, "Well, your mom's an alcoholic and I can't do it anymore." And I was just destroyed, and I thought that he was insane. And because I had no frame of reference, I had no friends to go over and see what a normal or a healthy family looks like. I had nothing like that, so it was just what it was. They went to couples therapy, and the therapist suggested that my brother and I go as well. I had no idea why I was there. I didn't understand what was going on. So all I talked to her about was the fact that I had no friends and that I wanted to make friends. And I asked her, "How can I make friends? How can I be this person that has friends?" And she wasn't able to help me, unfortunately, with that. So some traits that I had developed by the time I was 13, codependence, very learned behavior, independence and self-sufficiency with, having to teach myself everything and having to be so alone all the time. I learned how to do that. I was terrified of authority, absolutely terrified, because of my dad's rage. And then I was afraid of, I developed a fear of failure and success. Failure was painful for all the obvious reasons, but then success too, because nobody cared if I finished my math textbook in, 2 months. Nobody cared. It just was what it was. Well, good, you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, that kind of thing. So moving on to my teen years, I do have content warnings on parts of my talk today because I'm a firm believer that you need to take care of yourself. So if there's anything that I'm talking about that doesn't sit well with you, if you don't have the bandwidth for that today, I encourage you to take care of yourself and do what you need to do. This particular content warning is for suicidal ideation for this section. So finally, when I was a teenager, I convinced my mom to let me go back to public school, and I got to go to the next biggest town over, the 30 minutes away town, 45,000 people town, where there were actually people who didn't bully me. And it was amazing. And I made friends and I was so happy and I loved school. All of the friends that I made were from absolutely broken, dysfunctional homes as well. And we all bonded and we were all so close. And I'm still close with several of them today. My brother moved out when he was 16 and he moved in with my grandparents here in Minnesota. And then, I was in school, I was doing my own thing, and I became obsessed with trying to find a boyfriend, because due to my mom's conditioning, she had taught me that that's where my worth would come from, was having that boyfriend, having that relationship. My value was in how desirable I was to men and to boys. That was very firmly reinforced. I also got my first period when I was 15. It was actually on my 15th birthday. Fun. And that brought with it some really unexpected horrors. I didn't know it then, but I now know that I have PMDD. If you are unaware, I'm actually going to read this because it's a definition. PMDD is premenstrual dysphoric disorder. It is a cyclical hormone-based mood disorder with symptoms arising during the premenstrual or luteal phase of the menstrual cycle and subsiding within a few days of menstruation. It affects an estimated 5.5% of people who menstruate. That's from iapmd.org. I will happily share that link with anybody who wants it. That website is phenomenal, and I encourage anybody and everybody to learn about it because it's actually more prevalent than you'd think. And it takes like an average of 12 years for people to get diagnosed, which is a whole other issue. I could do a whole talk on that, but I won't today. But essentially, so PMDD is, it's basically like PMS turned up to 11. It's very, very commonly misdiagnosed as bipolar disorder. Because the symptoms are really similar. It's actually believed that Sylvia Plath had PMDD, not bipolar, because they've looked at her journals and it all syncs up. Symptoms include major mood swings, intense rage, feelings of hopelessness, anxiety, suicidal ideation, and more. And 30% of people with PMDD will attempt suicide in their lifetime. So I was dealing with this alone. I didn't have supportive family. I didn't have parents who gave a shit. And I had this horrible, horrible problem that I didn't know what to do with. I had my friends, but they were kids, we were all kids. And what are you going to do with that as a kid? And so I remember telling my mom when I was 15 or 16, I want to kill myself. And she said, it's just hormones. You'll be fine. I mean, I guess she was kind of right. I dealt with this every single cycle for 2 years before I went to a doctor, and I didn't go to the doctor for that. I went for physical pain because that was a lot easier to say, this is a problem that's actually a real problem, because I was missing school for how bad my cramps were. And she started me on birth control, and that helped. It helped keep the symptoms under control enough. And I did not get diagnosed at that point. I didn't know that PMDD was even a thing. I finally started dating guys. None of the relationships were even remotely healthy. They were all very codependent. They were all recreating my parents' awful relationship in various ways. But then I moved out of my parents' house when I was 16, almost 17, and I moved in with my brother in an apartment here in Minnesota. I moved across the country. I had two jobs, and I maintained perfect grades. I had like a 4.2 or something like that. And I was taking care of our apartment, and I was cooking and cleaning, and I did all these things as an adult child, and it was an interesting part of my life, that freedom. But some ACA traits that I had formed by the time I turned 18, I was extremely gossipy and judgmental. I talked about other people all the time, and it was not positive almost ever. I learned that from my mom. She still does that to this day. I had developed an inability to have fun. I had kind of forgotten how to play in my life quite a bit by then. I was very serious. I felt like I had to be, with my jobs and my home that I was maintaining as a child. I had phenomenally low self-esteem. And I had started absolutely self-abandoning. I was very people-pleasing. I had started figuring out and behaving in ways that I thought that other people wanted me to be. And then, of course, obviously, extremely intensified self-sufficiency and independence. Okay, so the next section here also has a content warning, this time for sexual assault. So again, if that's something that doesn't sit with you, or if you don't have the bandwidth, please do what you need to do. So after I was here in Minnesota for my junior year of high school, I graduated high school early and I moved back to Oklahoma for college. And I moved back because I was following a guy who I had met right before I moved up here. And talked to the whole time I was here, and that's all I wanted was to be with this guy. And that was one of my absolute unhealthiest relationships. It was on again, off again. There was no trust, there was no honesty, there was nothing good about it, honestly. He was it was extremely codependent. He was always sleeping with other people, and I was always just so angry, and I would be my dad and just explode with rage at him. But I looked to him to make me happy, and that's what I was looking for. I thought that he could and would make me happy, and make me feel loved. That was the beginning of a very long rock bottom of self-abandonment. I had been a vegetarian for years at that point, and this is Oklahoma, and so oh, meat eating is cool, and so I started eating meat again for this guy. I started smoking cigarettes. I started smoking pot, and hated it. That's a whole other story too. My body doesn't tolerate it well, so, but I did it because he did it, and it was important to him. And that was the thing. I started drinking. I tried to be everything that this guy wanted me to be. I wasn't myself, almost at all. And that relationship probably would have continued for many more years. It was about 4 years long. Probably would have continued for many more, but he got another woman pregnant, or so he thought. He married her, and then he ended up in prison shortly thereafter. So it was kind of out of my control, and he was out of my life. And at that point, I really started experimenting a lot with life and boundaries. I figured out that I really liked breaking rules when I thought that I could get away with it. And I got away with it a lot. And of course, there's that aspect of that that's, the addiction to excitement and the fear of getting caught. And there's, that part of it. And I got further into drugs and alcohol. I was trying to numb like constant pain from self-abandonment and unresolved trauma and this relationship that had ended that was just very painful. At one point during this whole attempt at grief, for this relationship, I was so depressed and so just gone that I didn't care if I lived or died at all. And I was just very numb, and I had a friend who was terrible with money, and he had this car that he was upside down in and on the payments for, and he wanted to get a new one so badly, and he couldn't afford it. And he told me one day, I really just wish that somebody would hit my car and total it, and then I could, get a new one through insurance. And I said, And he said, but I would just wreck it myself if I could, but they would know, and it would be this big deal, and I'd get in trouble. And I said, well, what if there was somebody else in the car with you? And so we wrecked his car on purpose. He hit a tree going 45 miles an hour on the passenger side, which was the side that I was on. And yeah, I didn't care at all. What I wanted to have happen was I wanted to get hurt because then I wanted that guy to have a reason to talk to me. Like, hey, I heard that you got in this terrible accident. I'm so sorry. I'm here for you. And he didn't. And I wasn't very hurt. I got pretty bad whiplash, but that was about it, thankfully. I dated more guys in that time. I really didn't care about most of them, and they were all pretty awful. They were actually just terrible people. And none of those relationships were healthy at all in any capacity. They were all very codependent. It was very much, I was trying to fix myself with other people. Obviously, it didn't work. But during that time, with my, boundaries, experimentation, I also figured out that I really enjoyed kissing girls too. But growing up, where I did and the environment that I did, I had been taught that, homosexuality is a sin. You can't do that. You're going to go to hell. And also that bisexuality doesn't even exist. You're either things that I heard when I was growing up, you're either straight or you're gay and you're lying to everybody. There's no such thing as bisexuality. And so it was really confusing. And also, I thought that men were where I got my value. So why would I pursue a relationship with a woman if men were the important people, right? So I didn't accept or acknowledge any part of that at that time. It was just a thing, oh, hey, I made out with my friend. That was fun. I ended up going in college to see a therapist for the second time in my life. I was about 18 or 19. She told me about the book Perfect Daughters. I was actually going to bring it, but I forgot it. But it's called Perfect Daughters, and it's about specifically women who grew up with alcoholic parents. I see some nodding. I read that book, and I read the back of the book in the bookstore after she recommended it to me, and I just started sobbing. Because it's kind of like the laundry list, right? And I had never felt so seen in my life. I read that book, I dog-eared it, I underlined it, I highlighted it. I loved that book, and it made me feel very, again, seen for the first time in my life. And so I thanked the therapist and I said, "Great, I'm good. I know why I am the way I am. I'm gonna move on now. I've accepted it. My mom's an alcoholic. I'm good. We're good." I had no concept of my dad's role in my childhood whatsoever at that point. I had no understanding. It was all about my mom right then. But I was good. I thought I was good. I had been dating a guy who had a friend who needed a place to live, and so I had a roommate for a while. It was my first roommate ever, actually, and we liked to party together. We would drink a lot. We would, smoke. We would take pills, things like that. And a lot of times we would do it with friends, and a lot of times it was just us. And one of the nights that it was just us, he raped me. I was very, very drunk. I passed out. It happened almost entirely while I was unconscious. And I woke up just in time to know what had happened. I didn't tell anybody, in part because I thought that it was because of me. Of course, why would I be so foolish to live with a man in the first place and then also to pass out with him there? I knew that he was interested. Anyway, I didn't tell anybody what happened. I didn't even really acknowledge it myself. Ended up kicking him out of my apartment, but because I didn't tell any of my friends, they didn't really know what happened. And so they thought I was just being unreasonable and, kicking this guy out of my home. And so the weekend that I left to give him time and space to get out of my home, My friends went over and had a party with them, and they just trashed my whole apartment. And so I was very lonely and isolated again, and I slipped very far into depression. And of course, I also developed anxiety from that, and it worsened some PTSD, and there were just a lot of things that came from that. And again, to try to fix myself with other people, I ended up dating a guy who was a complete piece of shit. I'm not going to get into the details, but he was horrible. And of course, I ended up getting engaged to this guy. I found out later after we broke up and everything, that he had shared intimate photos and videos that he had taken of me online without my knowledge or consent. There were other really awful things that he did, but I'm not going to go into that here today. So that whole series of events, from that roommate, to the end of that engagement and the things that happened after that, that really worsened, and caused a lot of the PTSD that I still feel today, especially nightmares. At that point, my self-abandonment was at an all-time high. My self-worth was at an all-time low. And I knew that I needed to change. I knew that what I was doing wasn't working. I didn't have the tools that I needed to fix it, but I knew that I needed to figure something else out. And so I graduated college in Oklahoma, of course, with 2 degrees and, a stellar GPA and all of those things. And I moved back here to Minnesota for a fresh start, because I knew I could pick wherever I wanted for the first time in my life. I didn't have to follow my dad's job anymore. So I said, I want to go live with my family. And my parents were like, okay, we'll come too. So they moved with me. So then after college, once I got up here to Minnesota, I knew I didn't want a boyfriend. I wanted to focus on myself. I thought that that was the appropriate step, right? I recognized that I was doing all these things. I was trying to use these people to fix me. And I knew that I couldn't do that anymore. I had had enough pain at that point and learned enough lessons that, nope, that's not going to work this time. And so I said, all right, I don't want a boyfriend. I'm just going to focus on me. But of course, I still liked being around people. I still really wanted that validation. So I started casually dating a guy, but I refused to let him say that we were official. Every time he'd say, oh, you're my girlfriend. No, I'm not. No, I'm not. And we carried on that way for a while. But then 3 months after we started doing that, my dad and my grandpa were in a horrible accident. It was a plane crash. And my family's full of pilots, and my dad and my grandpa were out on Labor Day flying my grandpa's motor glider. And somebody was taking off from the runway when they shouldn't have been. And so my grandpa had to take evasive action, and he went to do an emergency landing, which probably would have been pretty successful, except the field was full of soybeans and the vines like caught the gear and it just pitched the plane forward. And my grandpa died. And my dad had severe injuries. He broke a lot of things, his spine, his face, his feet. He had a traumatic brain injury, all these things. And this guy that I had been casually dating was there. I called him from, I was at a concert at the state fair with my friends, and I called him to come get me, and he didn't leave. He came and he got me. He took me to the hospital, and he stayed with me and with my family, who he had never even met. And then he, over the next few months, was very present. He was very kind and compassionate, and he cooked my mom and me dinner, and he would help out with my dad, and he did all these things. And for my grandpa's funeral, again, he had never met any of my family, but he sat at the very front of the church and held a webcam so that my dad could see it from the hospital. And of course, to all my family and my friends, I'm like, oh, this guy is amazing. He's so incredible. Oh my God, you have the best boyfriend ever. You can't leave this guy. And I got all this messaging from all these people, and I finally said, okay, fine. I guess you're my boyfriend now. And we moved in together pretty shortly thereafter, and I was so unhappy. I was so unhappy, and I denied that. I denied myself my happiness. I didn't, because everyone in my life was telling me, "That's perfect. This is what you want. This is what you should have." I was like, "Okay, I don't really know what it looks like. So if this is it, I guess I'm good." He was an alcoholic. He was extremely controlling. He would tell me what to wear, where, how to do my hair, how to do my makeup, that I couldn't get tattoos. I have a lot now, by the way. He would tell me all these things. He didn't want me hanging out with my friends alone. He would come out with my friends and me. Eventually, we moved to Farmington together. In part, I believe, because he wanted me to be further away from the people who were telling me that he wasn't good for me at this point. And we ended up getting married, but it was very short-lived. And I left. And while we had been together, I was pretending to be this person that I wasn't, and I was drinking a lot, and there was so much self-abandonment going on, and I was really starting to struggle because I had had a tiny taste of what my authentic self felt like, and I knew that wasn't it. And it was really hard not to want that and not to want to pursue that. So, after we got married, of course, the next logical progression in life, right, for people who are societally conditioned to believe so, is that you have to have kids now. So what happened is I quit taking birth control, and PMDD came back in full force. It was as bad as it was when I was a teenager, and I had no idea what to do. I was very lonely in it. I was so far away from my friends and my family, and I could still talk to them, obviously, but it was a half hour, 45 minutes if I wanted to go see any of them. I ended up Googling, am I bipolar? And I was looking at all these symptoms and stuff, and I found my way to that website, iapmd.org, and thankfully found what I actually was suffering with. So I was able to start this journey of figuring out how to solve it, which was awful. But the point there is, I was able to, through that process, realize, oh my God, I have all this stuff. I'm still not myself. I don't want to be with this person anymore. I don't want to have children with this person for sure. I don't want to have children at all, which is what I ended up figuring out, but knew I didn't want to have them with him, and I needed to fix it. So I left. Before I left, I found ACA through a friend at work. I started going in July of 2016. I hit my bottom in December of that same year. I left my husband. I torpedoed my job. I had to leave. I slid fully into codependency for a very short while there, again, trying to find worth from anyone I could. But thankfully, because I had found ACA by that point, I didn't stay there. I finally knew there's a better way forward. I don't have to do this anymore. So started clawing my way up, and I started rebuilding my life in authenticity and recovery. I have been for the last 6.5 years now, almost. So, through all of this, through all of these things, I ended up with a handful of diagnosed mental health conditions, PMDD, PTSD, and anxiety. And I had to try to figure out what I wanted to do with that. Because there are tons of potential treatments for all of those things, and not all of them work for everybody, and not all of them are helpful, and some of them are actually harmful. So it took a lot. It's taken a lot of unlearning and healing, and a shitload of work, constant effort, it feels like sometimes, but it's worth it. In addition to ACA, which has been one of the absolute most important pillars of my recovery, I also started, I went back to a therapist again for the fourth time. I think I missed a time in there in my story somewhere, but it's the fourth time. And I know that, I know now that I'm not fixed, right? I'm not over it now. And I don't know that I ever actually will be, right? But it's a journey. And I started doing EMDR. And if you're unfamiliar with what EMDR is, essentially it's a way to process trauma from your past that rather than reliving it and getting stuck in it, it's more like you're watching it on a movie screen. And so you can feel feelings in a safe place about what happened without feeling like you're actually in it. And it's extremely hard, but extremely powerful and very, very worth it. It's been tremendously helpful for me. But it works a lot better when you can actually be your true self. So there's some work that has to happen before that, I think. Another thing that I've been focusing on, especially lately, is healing this mind-body connection. Over the course of my life, I became so, so dissociated from my body. It made me angry when people would ask, when my therapist would ask, or when the Red Book would ask, where do you feel this in your body? I'd be like, do I have a body? I don't even know at this point. And it was really hard to get back to that. That took concentrated effort. It still does sometimes. Feeling your feelings as they come up is hard. It's so hard to do that, especially without practice. And especially if you haven't ever had a safe place to do that before, being able to trust that you do have a safe place and actually let yourself feel those feelings, it's really hard. And then of course I've done all of the annoying things that, you know, they tell you to do, right? Like exercise. Okay. Yes, that does help. Thanks. And, you know, mindfulness and meditation in whatever form works for you. For me, meditation is not, I'm going to sit still and I'm going to listen to Headspace or, you know, the Calm app or whatever, because that does not work for me. For me, it has to be like yoga. I have to be moving, which is really ironic given the dissociation that I used to have. Now the fact that I have to be in my body, feeling my body to be able to actually meditate in any meaningful capacity. Talking helps, talking to friends, talking to a therapist, talking to fellow travelers, talking to my husband, talking to people helps. Fresh air and sunshine helps. It's a simple thing, but going outside for a walk, even if it's cold outside, it helps. Doing things that bring you joy. I have bubbles in my car just for fun. You know, at work recently, I put a little crown on my headset and we do FaceTime Friday. So, 'cause we're all over the place. And so we're always on this channel for work. And on Fridays, we turn on our cameras and I put this little crown on my headset just because it was fun. And it's silly, but it's fun. It's all worth doing. And it's imperative that you have support in these things. You can't do this stuff alone. You can't tackle mental health alone. You can't tackle recovery alone. You have to work with people. You have to have people. I certainly would not be where I am today if it wasn't for the people who have helped me on this journey, and they are countless. The last part that I want to talk about is in recovery in general, and what that's looked like. I, over the course of the last 6.5 years or so, I started unburying my childhood memories, and I had to grieve so much. I am still grieving so much. I don't know if I'm ever going to stop. I was very angry for a long time. I just carried it around with me because that was the grief that felt most comfortable for me. That was the grief that I could manage until I got to where I felt safe feeling sad. I had to just be mad. And that was hard for myself and everybody around me. In recovery, I started dating Chris, which is the first relationship that I've ever had where, you know, we talk and like actually meaningfully talk. I came to realize that, I had abandoned myself for most of my life, and because not because of any fault with me, but because that was what I was taught. And I had to, because I didn't know any other way. Between my mom teaching me that self-worth comes from men, so that's where I sought it. Both of my parents taught me in various different ways to hide and deny my feelings. But in recovery, I've learned how to take responsibility for myself and accept my actions, accept my feelings, and own them. Good, bad, uncomfortable, comfortable, otherwise, they're mine, and I own them now. Fourth and fifth steps were really, really, really hard for anybody who's done them. I know you know. But that process of taking the first actual real look at myself, at who I am, where I've been, what has happened to me, what I've done to other people, and to be completely honest about that, to be absolutely authentic in that, and to share that with other people, it was one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life, but the reward was immeasurable. That was the first time in my life that I actually became able to know and accept and love myself. Not this person that I had created for everybody else around me, not this person who just did what everybody else thought she should, but for me, the actual me. I learned how to name my feelings. That process sucked. I did not like that. To do that, I got myself this little sparkly pink journal. It had to be glitter and pink, or I would have thrown it in the garbage so many times. And what I did, because I was in meetings and people would talk about their feelings, and I would be like, how do you know? Like, how do you know what you're feeling in this moment? And one of my fellow travelers, I don't know if she's here today, but she gave me this, sorry for the language, this fucking feelings wheel. I hated this wheel so much for so long. But I put it in the back of this notebook. And what I did was, I also wrote a bunch of feelings words in the front so that I could refer back to them. Ones that I felt, okay, yeah, I think I felt this in my life. And I set alarms on my phone for 3 times a day. And it was always just random. Like when I was pretty sure I'd be like sitting at my desk at work or eating my dinner or whatever, 3 different times every single day, my alarm would go off. And I would stop what I was doing and I would sit down and I'd open up this stupid little journal and I would think, okay, I would make myself write 3 words. I would write, I'm feeling, and then I made myself pick 3 different words, because otherwise I knew I would just be like, I'm feeling fine, done, you know? And so in doing that, I was able to, when I wasn't feeling powerful feelings, I was just hanging out at work, I was able to sit down and think, okay, what am I feeling? Well, I'm working on this thing and I'm feeling frustrated because it's not working. And I'm feeling excited because I get to go on a date with Chris later. And I'm feeling nervous because I have to take my dog to the vet. You know, I would write just these 3 feelings, and it took, I'm not joking, 6 months of doing that every single day until I got to a point where I felt confident that at any given moment, if you ask me, how are you feeling? I can answer honestly. I hated that whole process so much. But then once I learned to name them, then I learned how to feel them. And that process was arguably worse. It was extremely challenging to start to get comfortable with that process. Okay, I'm feeling nervous. Rather than feeling nervous about taking my dog to the vet and then being like, oh, I don't like that, moving on, I had to learn to sit with it. Okay, I'm feeling nervous about taking my dog to the vet. What does that mean? Well, that means this is how I feel in my body. This is what I'm afraid of. Here's the whole tape. Tape plays all the way through. What does that mean for me? To this day, I still struggle a lot to sit with sadness specifically, because sadness for a very long time terrified me. I never had anybody growing up to help me, sit with it and to comfort me, and I didn't have anybody to teach me how to comfort myself. And so to this day, when I feel overwhelming sadness, it's an active effort to sit with it. And sometimes I still can't. I sometimes still say, nope, this is too much. I am done. And that's okay too. I learned how to communicate vulnerably and authentically. That was something that I've learned how to do in recovery. I did not want anything to do with that for a very long time. I still remember one of the first times that I got upset with Chris, and he's like, let's talk about this. I was like, why would we do that? Why? That does not seem like a good idea. But then we did, and I felt better afterwards. I'm like, wait a minute. Now you're going to stop talking to me for a while, though, right? Because I told you I'm mad at you. No, I'm going to not do the thing that you got mad at me about, and I'm going to apologize for it. What? What is this? And now it's to the point where, with anybody, not just Chris, but anybody, including, my colleagues at work or my boss, as it recently happened, if I'm upset about something, I can't not talk about it. Like, it's gotten to the point where I can't hold that anymore. I have to share, and I've learned how to do it in a way that isn't, how dare you do this to me? It's, I'm feeling this way as a result of this. Can we talk about that? Where are you coming from with this? And it's just so different. Feels a lot better. Also in recovery, I stopped oversharing with strangers as much. I used to do that all the time. I would just trauma dump on anybody. Literally, the cashier at the gas station would say, how are you doing? And I'd be like, well, my dad was just in a plane crash and I'm not doing well. Here's how I feel about it. But I don't do that anymore because I have safe people to talk to. And I know how to find safe people to talk to. And I also know how to ask, hey, I have some really heavy stuff I need to talk about. Do you have space for that? And that's pretty huge. I weeded my people garden. I started choosing. And continue to choose to spend time with people who can be real and kind and honest. And I have removed people from my life as best as I can who aren't that way. Or I keep them at arm's length if there's a reason to keep them in my life, or if I have to, if it's a colleague or something like that. And I set boundaries with them. But I have been so empowered by choosing people in my life who can see and can be with the real me, the authentic me, and can be that themselves. And it's so different. And I cannot fathom any of my friends this isn't going to happen, but if I were to say, I'm kicking Chris out tomorrow, I can't imagine any of them coming to my house and throwing a party. It's just not a thing. I began finding value and worth in myself just for being me, not for anything that I've done, not for my job, not for my grades in college, not for my degrees or how much money I make or how I look or how many friends I have. Just being me is enough for me to have worth. And that's huge. The traits, I've released as many of them as I have been able to so far that weren't serving me, and I've integrated a lot of them. My self-sufficiency and independence has come in phenomenally helpful for things like work because I'm learning a new role, and that takes a lot of resourcefulness and a lot of self-starter whatever mentality to really pursue that effectively and to be good at it. And I'm really grateful for that skill that I have learned, very hard-earned skill, but I have it, and it's really a useful one for me to integrate. And then with hobbies at home too, you know, I learned how to crochet when I was a kid from my mom, but I get patterns all the time, and they have like harder or different stitches, and I'm never afraid to do it. You know, it's really, I just look it up, you know, or if there's, I started buying a lot of plants at the beginning of the pandemic. And I always used to kill plants, and I decided I wanted, you know, I wanted nature, I wanted something to get me through, you know, the couple of months that we'd be in lockdown, haha. And I had these orchids, and I love orchids, and I just was like, you know what, I always kill orchids, I'm not going to do that this time. I probably watched like 4 hours of orchid videos on YouTube, but now I get them to bloom over and over and over. So my self-sufficiency has been very helpful for just generally enjoying my life. I started removing the traits that I didn't need. The fear of authority, I knew that had left when Chris is already laughing. When I got pulled over by a police officer a couple of years ago because I was speeding. I was going 18 over on 494 South, leaving his place. And I knew that I had gotten over my fear of authority when I started mouthing off to the cop. So I was like, you know, everybody else in front of me was going faster than I was. I don't think it's fair that you pulled me over. It's like, you were going 18 over. Yes, and I got a ticket. Once I started learning how to love myself, I stopped gossiping about people almost entirely. I didn't feel the need to talk about other people that way anymore. I stopped judging other people because I wasn't judging myself. I wasn't seeing all of my faults in them. I was seeing them. And it's so much better to see the world that way and to see people that way. I stopped people pleasing almost entirely. I still do it sometimes. I still catch myself, and that's okay. But I still remember one of the first times that I said no, just by way of stopping people pleasing. It was, my sister-in-law was having a gender reveal party, and I received the invitation in the mail. And for anybody who knows me, you know, I consider myself a rabid feminist. And so I received this invitation, and it said guns or glitter, and I nearly vomited on the spot, and I did not appreciate the gendering of guns or glitter. And anyway, I sat with it for a minute, and I thought, I don't want to go to this. I don't have anything else going on. I'm free that day. I would rather eat glass than go to this gender reveal party. And so I just texted her. I said, hey, I'm sorry. I won't be able to make it to your party. I hope you have a great time. I didn't lie. I didn't make up an excuse. I didn't say, oh, I'd really love to be there. I just said no. And she was like, okay, that's all right. I appreciate that. And I was like, I can just say no. What is this magic? And so I started doing that more when I didn't want to do things, or when people would ask me things and I didn't want to share that information with them, or whatever it was. I just started saying no. And it was little things at first, and then it was all kinds of things that I have no guilt anymore for saying no about. And it's amazing. And of course, that's all part of, you know, setting and honoring boundaries for yourself, right? That was hard to learn as well, because growing up, I had no boundaries. I had none. I told anyone everything all the time. I gave all of myself to everyone else around me all the time. And that's what was expected of me. I was supposed to. I was my mom's emotional support child, right? So I didn't learn how to set any kind of boundaries. And once I started in ACA learning how to set boundaries, man, that was a train that never stopped. It's still hard sometimes, but It's also so empowering. A really great example is that for work every year we go to this conference in Vegas, and it's a big deal. It's a lot of fun, and my team is large and very tight-knit. And so we all stay in like this, these hotels suites. And this year it was actually at a giant Airbnb, like a huge house. There were like 20 of us in this one house. But I was really uncomfortable with the prospect of sharing a room and also common spaces with that many people for that long, especially colleagues. And so I talked to my boss about it. I said, "Hey," I didn't have to tell him, "Hey, I have this horrible trauma with sharing a space with a guy in my past," or like, "Hey, I have this horrible trauma around like family events where I feel like an outsider, so I have to sit to the side." I didn't have to give him any of that information. All I did was came to my boss and I said, "Hey, I would really be more comfortable if I could have my own room. Is that possible? Can we make that happen? I'm fine getting a hotel room somewhere. I'm fine, staying somewhere close by the house where everybody else is. I just really need my own space to get away." And he said, "Of course." And he made it happen. And that was a boundary that I set. And I was so grateful to have that space while I was there. And 7 years ago, I would have just been like, "Oh, I guess I'm sharing a room with my friend Jared," I've learned to live in my authentic self every day. I embrace as many parts of myself as humanly possible, as often as possible. It's still sometimes hard, especially when I'm feeling, when I'm in my luteal phase and I'm feeling crappy in general about life. But I really do try hard to look at and embrace those parts of me. I finally allowed myself within the last couple of years to accept and be honest and open about the fact that, yes, I am actually bisexual. That's okay. And I'm probably not going to go to hell for it. I allow myself to express myself however I want to, however feels good for me, as long as I'm not hurting anyone else, whether that's with my words or my actions or my clothes or my hair or my makeup or the activities that I do. I just let myself be myself, and however I come out as myself, however I show up, is okay. I share this authenticity with as many other people as I can, and I give them space to share their own authenticity with me with no judgment. And I don't say that like, "Oh, I'm not going to judge you, but I'm really secretly judging you." No, I say no judgment, and I mean no judgment, because I'm capable of that now. Didn't used to be, but I am now. I formed a sense of my own spirituality. It's still tenuous at best, and it's not something that I'm really able to rely on often, or think to. But when I do think to, it's at least there. I've let go of a lot of resentments. I still carry some around. I think that's kind of just maybe how I am, but and that's okay too. I've almost entirely stopped communicating with my parents. That's one of those weeding the people garden parts. I keep them pretty far away, and I feel better for it. I really do. I don't know that cutting them out entirely is right for me, but if it was, I know that I could do that, and that's okay too. I have started to see the promises come true for me, and I see them every day, little by little and big by big, for the last 6 years, thanks a lot to my own hard work and all of the things that I've done and this journey that I've been on, but also thanks to all of you, all of the people in this room, all of you on Zoom, all of the people in all of the rooms over the years. I could not have done any of this without you all. I mean, it's not possible to recover alone. So I'm so grateful for this community and for everyone here and for everyone listening now, later, whenever. Thank you all for helping me become me. It's the greatest gift that I've ever gotten. So that is all I have for you all today. Thank you for listening.
so much, Jess. And we have room till 1 o'clock. Well, we have to be out completely by 1 o'clock, but please stay and socialize and grab some treats. And yeah, great to see everybody here. Now, talk ACA.
You guys get stuff.